When you're on stage in a performance with a live orchestra, you don't think much beyond the steps and the timing of the choreography, which is why I chose this next remarkable guest to talk through what happens the other side of the curtain. Introducing the principal conductor and soon-to-be music director of the Birmingham Royal Ballet and the Royal Ballet Sinfonia, Paul Murphy. Paul studied at the Royal Academy of Music and has been working as a conductor in ballet for 32 years. He has conducted all the famous ballet classics, such as The Sleeping Beauty, Swan Lake, and The Nutcracker, and has worked on ballets with the incredible David Binney, who was actually the director of the company when I was there. He has also toured many parts of the world. I had no idea just how challenging it is to be a conductor and a musician in the orchestra pit. We talk about Paul's amazing journey, how you can become a ballet conductor through a fellowship program, and how much you have to adapt as a conductor for ballet, plus advice from a musician's, conductor's, and dancer's perspective. It's incredible. Let's go. So, Paul, how did you become a conductor for the Birmingham Royal Ballet?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The answer is by accident. I was freelancing, having left music college, where I trained as a piano player and a singer, and then decided to specialize in conducting. And after I left, I freelanced for about 4 years. I didn't have a great deal of work. I conducted lots of amateur orchestras, youth orchestras, some professional dates, but very at a very low level. And one day, literally out of the blue, I had a phone call. I was then living in Cambridge. This would have been 1991. From a member of the Royal Ballet Sinfonia, Birmingham Royal Ballet, and this member is still in the orchestra. And she said to me, because she played for me in a concert a few months earlier, and said there was a vacancy at Birmingham Royal Ballet for a staff conductor. Would I be interested? My reply was, well, I don't know, because I've never conducted for ballet in my life. I don't know really anything about ballet, apart from the fact that I've seen a couple of ballets. I've seen a triple bill at the Dance Theatre of Harlem when I was a student. I've never seen a classical ballet in its entirety. I only knew the music, but I'd never really seen the staging. So she said, well, why don't you write in? And in those days, it was literally writing.
No phones.
No phones, no email. It's 1991. So I wrote in to the administration, the orchestra administration of Birmingham Royal Ballet. And I said, this is who I am. This is what I've done, which wasn't a great deal. I was 28 at the time. And I heard nothing for about 6 months. And then I got a call from the then orchestra administrator who said, would you like to come in and observe what we do for 3 months? And we'll pay you for nice. 3 months. I mean, it wasn't a huge amount of money, but as I was freelancing and basically not earning very much, I was delighted to have the opportunity. So I came into this very building, the Birmingham Hippodrome, in February 1992. So it was 6 months after I had the call in 91. And I sat in the studios with dancers. I spent a lot of time talking to pianists, the staff pianists. I spent a lot of time talking to the conductors. I went to orchestral rehearsals. I basically tried to simulate how a classical ballet company functions. And when I got here, it turned out there were three of us. One of whom I knew very well, a colleague from the Royal Academy of Music, where I studied, and another conductor I didn't know very well, but got to know. And it turned out that they were trying us out, basically.
Oh.
So that we were all together for 3 months observing, and then we were all given the same two pieces in a triple bill in three different venues on tour. And the two pieces were a ballet called The Burrow, which was a Kenneth Macmillan one-act ballet with music by Franck Martin, a Swiss composer, a very tricky piece for wind instruments and strings, some percussion. And Les Sylphides, which of course is a very famous one-act ballet set to Chopin, and very balletic and very tricky. The third piece was Elite Syncopations, which we worked in because it has piano conducto. I remember vividly my stint was in Canterbury at the Marlowe Theatre. Oh, I haven't been back since, I must admit, but I know it's still in very much in circulation as a touring venue for other companies and theatre companies up and down the country. But I did my two or three shows. It seemed to go okay. I enjoyed it. It was a very different experience for me. I wasn't really sure what I was doing, but I got some positive feedback. So I thought, well, that's it, really. Thank you very much. A few days later, I got another phone call saying we'd like you to come back and do another triple bill.
Wow.
But this time, rehearse the orchestra a little bit, because the first time I didn't get any rehearsal, apart from what we call a seating call, which is when we get into a new venue. The orchestra sit in the pit. We have half an hour just to basically to get accustomed to the space. Yeah, so this time it was a full triple bill to myself, and the repertoire was Stravinsky Card Game, the Jeu de Cartes, which is a very tricky score, and a great score and great fun to get out. And then dancer choreographer in the company called Oliver Hindle. I don't know if you remember him.
No.
He made a ballet to Shostakovich String Quartet, orchestrated for string orchestra. And then the big piece was a ballet called Coriatium, which was set to Brahms' Fourth Symphony, which is a war horse for in the symphonic repertoire, and not the sort of piece I would ever have expected to do as a ballet. And it was by choreographed by Massine back in the 20s, I presume, or maybe 30s. I'm not exactly sure, but it was choreographed. Very old-fashioned, but for a huge ensemble. So the tempi were very fixed. So, but I did shows in Bristol, I think. I think it was Bristol.
Oh,
three performances.
Near my hometown.
And again, it seemed to go pretty well. I was quite pleased with it. And again, I left, I went home. And 2 days later, I had a phone call from Barry Wordsworth, who was then the music director of Birmingham Ballet. He rang me and said, Paul, how would you like to come and work for us full time? And I was really quite taken aback, because it was a bit of a shock. And I hadn't really considered that that would be the outcome, although I knew they were looking for someone. And all I forgot to tell you is when I came back, the other two were no longer there. It was just
me.
Oh,
gosh. So you were in competition.
Yeah. That all became clear as we went through the 3 months. So, yeah, and then I accepted, which is then for a staff conductor, which was basically to fill in when required. We used to call it the T-boy role, because we had, whereas now we have fellowships and we have mentoring and so on. In those days, that really didn't exist. So we had to learn by just jumping in. Literally jumping in and doing shows with either minimal or no rehearsal. And all the classics, for example, Sleeping Beauty, Quaggers, All Night, I did La Fee, all of that I did, all those ballets I did for the first time with no rehearsal. So, and when I started the job in September 1992, within, I would say, a month, I realized that I really didn't know anything at all about ballet.
Right.
And spent, I would say, a good 5 years learning the ropes, trying to learn the ropes, getting a lot of feedback, a lot of negative feedback from the ballet staff, because I was trying to work out exactly how to do it, at the same time how to make music. And I struggled, because it is a specialty, there's a very fine line that you can't cross because of the, I wouldn't say limitations of choreography, but because what choreography means to dancers from a musical perspective. So And it took me that time to actually realize that what you have to do is lead and not follow. So this was the one mistake that I made repeatedly, which was trying to be too visual, trying to be over-accommodating, and therefore what was happening is that things were slowing down a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So, but knowing that you can lead, but also how to lead. Nowadays, I talk about leading whilst wearing a straitjacket. Now, that is very blunt and very extreme, but in a way, it sort of gives you the idea, because there are limitations of what you can do in terms of taking the music in one direction or another, but you still have to lead, otherwise it doesn't function.
Yeah, because you've got the dancers who've got that very specific choreography. They have to be in places by the count of eight, you know, so it's so important. It's a collaboration that you're working together. But yeah, I guess you do have to lead because you are anticipating. And yeah, it's tough. It's harder than I ever thought. Me being on stage, I was just like, the music's playing and it's beautiful. That was as far as it went. And I'm pretty sure that that is how it goes. So it's so nice to hear what it's like the other side of the curtain.
Yeah, and if you think about what it's like from the orchestra's perspective, they're sitting sometimes in very cramped conditions, sometimes in very uncomfortable conditions for noise, as we call it, for lack of a better word. So sound levels can be very high.
Okay.
Because the space is cramped or there's a large overhang from the stage. So the musicians who are playing under the overhang are trapped in a sort of, you know, very unpleasant place for their ears. But more importantly than that, so factoring all that in, they can't see anything of the stage.
No.
All they have is the conductor. And the conductor has to relay the information from the stage to them. But what they're looking for, whereas they understand the speciality and understand that the tempi will be flexible, they're looking for the conductor to be a conductor. So in other words, to be no different in terms of actual conducting to a conductor who will conduct a symphony or an opera or a chorus. So the actual function of what we do, you know, is no different at all to our colleagues in the other genres of conducting. So from the orchestra's perspective, they're looking for you to guide them, not only through the sort of web of choreography, but also to enhance their performance as well by lifting the music. So we have to be clocking in, obviously, a lot to the dancers, and in particular in classical ballet, to the solos and the duets, but also really connecting with the orchestra a lot.
Gosh.
A lot. We can't spend a three-hour performance glued to the stage, because the orchestra will switch off and lock in, so, and almost disregard the conductor. I've seen that in opera a lot, where some opera conductors, for lack of a better, I hate saying opera conductors, ballet conductors, choral conductors, because basically we're all the same. But shall we say conductors who conduct opera a lot? I've seen performances where they are literally glued to the singers from beginning to end, and the orchestra switch off. They're not engaged, and it becomes a dull performance. So our role is very much multitasking.
Yeah.
But essentially, we should never lose track of the fact that we are fundamentally conductors. We are not dancers. But we have to know our specialism.
God, that's fascinating, because, again, it's something you don't think about. I mean, I've never thought about how they feel trapped and how uncomfortable, the acoustic level, but also how you have to, yes, engage with the dancers on the stage, but you have to encourage them as well. Otherwise they switch off. It's something that it makes sense. It makes perfect sense, because if you are their guide, but you're not really guiding them, it's all about the dancers. Yeah, you would switch off, rightly or wrongly, but you would, you need that engagement, that encouragement to be like, I mean, I've never conducted in my life, so forgive me if I'm doing something, you go, that's not how it looks. But, you know, just having that notion and being encouraging.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the challenge arises particularly in a long run of something the orchestra knows very well. So we're about to embark on a revival of the Sleeping Beauty here at Birmingham Ballet. We open in Southampton, we go 2 weeks in Birmingham, and it goes on the road, I think, for a total of 8 weeks. That's an awful lot of performances of the Sleeping Beauty, probably in excess of 40. Now, we will engage several conductors to do that. It wouldn't be just the one conductor. But the orchestra will largely stay the same. Some players will rotate because our particular orchestra is not on a full-time contract. So they have a license to explore other avenues of work and pick up some freelance engagements, etc. But the sort of core or the body of the orchestra will remain roughly the same. And that's an awful lot of repetition. Again, there's a sort of a bit of pressure constantly on the conductor to keep it alive, because orchestras who know the piece very well don't want the conductor to interfere. Well, there's a fine line between interfering and making it come alive. So yes, you can't disturb what they can do already, but it needs your role is to imagine that there's someone in the audience who's never heard the piece at all. And there will be.
Of course.
In every show, there will be someone, it might be a child, who has never heard the piece before, and of course never seen the piece before. So it's our duty always to give it something extra. So, and it's difficult. It's difficult. Repetition is one of the things in our in theatre, which is very different to the concert hall. Because if I was engaged to do, you know, a symphonic concert as a freelancer, there might be two performances. Then they'd be on to another conductor with another program.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. I've just been in Finland guesting. I did 17 performances of a new ballet. That is a lot for a theatre piece. But and ballet tends to have more performances than opera as well. So we did again the more pressure on us as conductors to keep it fresh as much as we can without destroying it and without disrespecting what the players can do themselves.
Mm.
So it's constantly a challenge.
How do you, if you could give me an example of how you engage and encourage and keep things fresh?
There are several ways you can do it, really. I mean, there are some conductors who prefer literally to let the orchestra just find its own rhythm. I don't mean rhythm in the literal sense, in its own flow, and in a way let the performance evolve. So that because it's live, it will naturally evolve differently every show anyway. So essentially not to interfere too much, but to give, you know, a bit more for the louds, a bit less for the softs, a little bit more for the speed ups, a bit less for the slowing downs. And of course, that will be dictated by the choreography as well sometimes. Or you can do that, of course, and also on top, then try and go for some new things that the orchestra perhaps are not expecting.
Okay.
Once in a while, we call it rat in a cage. and sometimes it doesn't work. And sometimes it does. It depends who's really switched on and who's engaged. But obviously, it can't be anything radical.
No.
By definition, being a ballet, it has to be fairly consistent. Mm. Because we are not the only players. The dancers are very much as part of the whole as we are. And they're not expecting anything radically to change. But I mean subtle things, you know, like going for something in the score, bringing something out, perhaps, looking at a player in a place where you've never looked at them before. And when they respond, it can be really, really exciting. You know, sometimes it's a brass chord or something in the percussion or something lyrical on the strings, just a bit more than they normally do. Or maybe sometimes what we do is we encourage things like an echo when they're not expecting it, but they haven't rehearsed. And this orchestra, our orchestra, the Mobile Sinfonia, are so responsive to any conductor that's on the podium, that, you know, 9 times out of 10, they'll react instantaneously. Normally smiles around and normally thinking, oh, what's he doing? So things like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's so, magic.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It must be incredible to create that, be the leader, to create that, but surprise them, keep them on their toes. I think there is something to that. I mean, sometimes on the 40th show, I remember doing Swan Lake, I was exhausted, and you do have to get a little bit creative, and sometimes you'll give someone a little look or something, anything that just brings it to life a little bit, because it needs to stay fresh. Like you said, that there could be a child that's never seen a ballet, never heard the music score, And so for that person, and for, you know, for people who haven't seen it, it needs to be magic when they go.
And sometimes maybe just also for the dancers, sometimes we might just put our foot on the gas once or twice. Just to inject a little bit of surprise.
Ah, cheeky, cheeky. I think I've witnessed this.
Yeah, of course, not too much.
Yeah.
Just so enough so it just doesn't become, you know, of course, dancers have muscle memory in the same way that conductor for dance has to have tempo memory. And our bodies get used to that repetition and the way that feels. So it's nice sometimes just to have something else.
Yeah. So what's the training like to being a conductor?
Well, it varies. These days it's a lot more structured. And in fact, the structuring had begun when I started back in the 1980s. So I trained at the Royal Academy of Music. I had four wonderful teachers, Connie Messers. In fact, Colin Messers used to be a staff conductor in this company and sat as well.
Right.
Yeah, many years ago. So he has some experience of ballet, although his background was mainly symphonic. George Hurst, who was his teacher, who was a sort of legendary British conductor, although he wasn't born here. And then John Carew, who approached conducting from a very different perspective, more analytical, more based on actually analysing the harmony and the flow of the internal structure of a piece. He was Simon Rattle's teacher. So, and then Sir Colin Davis, who's sadly no longer with us, he was the international chair of conducting. And so we saw him once a year, and he came and did masterclasses with us. We also had choral conducting experience with a brilliant German choral director called Horst Neumann, where we had to really develop our ear and our oral skills by, you know, finding pitches with just a tuning fork.
Oh,
help from a piano and things like that in complex pieces with complex harmonies. So I was very lucky. I went to, at that time, Royal Academy of Music. That course was brilliantly structured. I had an awful lot of experience, hands-on experience, not just with pianos, but also with orchestral ensembles. And that has continued, and it's being developed. There are some wonderful teachers now all over the world, some very famous conductors who've got more of a reputation of being pedagogue than actually on the podium. Right. You know, I can think of Ilya Mursin in Russia, who's no longer with us, but he is a legendary Russian teacher who produced some fantastic famous conductors, like Valery Gergiev and so on. Jorma Panula in Finland, all that generation of Finnish conductors have come through his academy. Colin Metis here, just to name but three. There are many others in America and so on. So these days, the courses are really worth a young conductor exploring because of the opportunities they provide. So, and then of course, going from a course into the profession that's very difficult.
Really?
Yeah, and it's still difficult because there's so much competition now. And okay. Of course, in recent years, you will be surprised that we now have many more female colleagues than we used to have. I mean, women conductors were very much around when I started, but there weren't very many of them. And now there's been an explosion of women conductors, many of whom are absolutely brilliant. But all of that has meant is the market is even more crowded. So it's very difficult now, especially in UK, to find a position. So many conductors are trying different routes. There are competitions, of course. Competitions can lead to engagements, can lead to getting a good agent, but they're a lottery. The chances of winning one are very slim. I wouldn't say they're as slim as winning the lottery, but it's, you know, there's a great element of luck and subjectivity involved. If you're a good pianist, you can still follow the opera route by being a repetiteur, so going to playing coach singers and eventually moving on and developing your conducting skills by joining an opera house. Probably Germany or somewhere in Europe is a much better avenue. It's much harder here. Which leads me on to, if you were used to doing ballet as a young conductor, then that used to be, you know, pretty much starting as I did, or playing piano for dancers, playing for class, playing for rehearsals, and then getting an opportunity to conduct the old show. But now we have a wonderful fellowship here, which we developed, called the Constant Library Conducting Fellowship. It's very unique. It's in collaboration with the Royal Ballet, and it's every biannually, so every 2 years.
Okay.
And for 2 years, we immerse the successful film who we audition in ballet for 2 years, and they don't have to have any experience of conducting for ballet. They just have to be a good conductor, and we immerse them in all aspects of what we do, and we give them conducting opportunities as well as covering, and it's fully mentored for the 2 years. And at the end of the 2 years, our hope is that we can retain their services as freelance.
Okay.
And also that they can have ballet as part of their portfolio, as opposed to making exclusive. So they don't have to be specialist dance conductors like I am, which was never my intention, but it's how my career has developed. But they can, you know, they can come in and out of ballet, whereas ballet was always perceived as a closed shop.
Right.
For a lot of conductors, because of the degree of flexibility you need to have. And it's proven to be incredibly popular. And also, it's been very successful.
That's great.
In our first three victims, if you like, we're using, and in fact, Jonathan Lowe, the first person to have gone through, not the Castle Lambert, it was the BBC Performing Arts Fellowship. He's gone on to be music director of Australian Ballet. Wow. And he was music director of Northern Ballet, and he's also freelancing regularly at the Royal Opera House. So he's been a tremendous success. He's decided to be a dance conductor. And following him, we had Thomas Jung from Germany, who's made it part of his portfolio, but he's coming back to us. And the last one was Charlotte Politi, Italian-French conductor, who's currently doing the Nutcracker at the Royal Opera House.
Nice.
Who also has been the London Philharmonic's coach conductor. And we currently have Yi Wei, a young Chinese conductor, we've yet to try out yet, but he's also very gifted. We had over 90 applications for our last fellowship round.
Goodness me, that's
so
brilliant.
So it's increasing in its popularity and its success. So we're absolutely thrilled. And I feel it incumbent on me and my generation of conductors that we should give back.
I had no idea that it was such a closed shop, that it was so niche. And that's so few of you. So I think that's a wonderful thing to make people aware of.
Well, I think it used to have a sort of Cinderella reputation, being a dance conductor, because of the compromises sometimes we have to make musically. And that is not the fault of any individuals, by the way. Well, it is the fault ultimately of choreographers down the lines who've made steps that are undanceable beyond a certain tempo. And when the music has to accommodate that, sometimes the distortions are huge. And that has deterred an awful lot of conductors, because they simply don't want to do it. They don't want to respond in that way to music, to make that much of a compromise. But my answer to that is, well, yes, that is true up to a point. But there's a direct parallel with 19th century opera. And I always use Bellini and Donizetti, for example. You can't conduct those pieces without knowing how singers function. And there are an awful lot of traditions in it where the singers take liberties. Okay, the common denominator is music. It's not, so the conductor is still being oral rather than visual. And those singers, of course, can be tremendously exciting doing what they do. But it's also the same with dancers. And the biggest lesson I learned was doing Act Two of the Nutcracker in concert, where I finally felt I could purge myself of all these slow tempi and do it exactly as the metronome marks were in the score, as Tchaikovsky so say intended. And I remember doing this and thinking, finally, I've done the trade pack like this. Finally, the Arabian dance I can pick up, et cetera, et cetera. And I came off, I felt so flat, because I realized that actually the success of Act Two of Nutcracker is the applause between the numbers. And the applause between the numbers is because of the dance layer on top of the music. So actually the musical compromises that we make, I wouldn't say they don't matter. Of course they matter if they go ridiculously too slow, which is sometimes the case in some versions. But you need it. You need the dance element. And if you walk it through it, as is written in the score, especially the Arabian dance is frighteningly fast. In the New York City Ballet, Balanchine version, I'm pretty sure it's just one Arabian dancer, a female, and with finger cymbals. And that choreography is pretty much what Tchaikovsky wrote. And if you factor in, you know, the idea of making it pas de deux or pas de trois, it's not going to be so easy to do that tempo.
Yeah, be impossible for us to move that
quickly. Absolutely. And that's how Peter conceived it. So what we try and do in that case is we try and reach a compromise. So we are constantly saying, okay, I understand this is how it was made. Can we just try and maybe just an edge quicker? And in some cases, the other way, you know, very often in ballet, because it's something that's mise-en-scène, or I'll give you an example, Polonaise. Now, this is something that has always sort of slightly riled me, because a Polonaise should be slow. The Polonaise is a slow, stately dance in 3/4. It should never be quick. And there are ballet Polonaises where we're constantly asked to move it on. Move it on. Please, will you kind of move it on? And again, it's asking that question. I understand you're just walking around in a circle. This particular Polonaise, I'm thinking of Acts 3 of Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, yeah. One, all the two, characters. Swish.
Yeah.
Two,
when they all come on.
Yes.
But really, what Tchaikovsky's intention was to make it steady. Of course, to make the production work, we can't do as steady as we like. So I always ask for a little bit of a compromise and not be able to scale them all the way through it.
Yeah. It's incredible to learn. But what do you think is the most incredible part of your job?
Well, I think the most incredible part is to be in the middle of the most incredible music. There are some scores which are a gift for a conductor. I'm thinking of the three actors. I'm thinking obviously Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
I'm thinking Cinderella.
Yeah.
Those are two standouts. Go, okay, they both happen to be about Prokofiev. And to be just in the middle of that, regardless of it being a ballet, is such a thrill.
Yeah.
And then if you put the extra layer on top, on the, I wouldn't say rare nights, but it's not every night, where it all comes together. You have a cast that were basically just in sync. They're going with the flow of the music. You're compromising to the correct amount.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is working. And also, you know, like yourself, our standards are very high. And we have some really amazing shows. We have some shows that we'd rather forget immediately. It's just the nature of it being live theater. And that's generally not the fault of any individuals. It's just like performance. And sometimes those shows, you come off and you think, oh dear. And then other people say, hey, it was amazing tonight. So it's your own personal standards. But on those occasions where you feel it's gone very well, everyone on stage is on high. And you feel that you get such a buzz from the music. The orchestra are obviously playing to the top of their game. That's a pretty special moment. And you tend to be on a high for a while afterwards, and then normally have to do a matinee the next day. that is a real thrill. And also performing in certain venues as well. I mean, the Royal Opera House. I mean, it's a beautiful venue.
It is,
and it's my heart rate increases just as I walk onto that podium. I mean, you think of the amount of superstar conductors who've been there. Just it's such an honor and privilege to actually be in the theater. I've been very lucky. I've conducted there. I've got La Scala, which is a beautiful acoustic as well. The Teatro Colón in Argentina. Again, I think it's a real acoustic thrills and beautiful buildings. Yeah, so the venue can also sort of contribute to that special evening.
Yeah.
Special experience, rather.
I was just thinking about Romeo and Juliet as you said it, and my heart just went, that music. I mean, if anyone's not heard Romeo and Juliet, you must. It really is stunning. And there's that piece in Cinderella when she's coming down the stairs. Yeah. Just that I get so, so emotional. And there were moments when I was on stage, Carmina Burana is another one that stands out to me, where I was welling up. I was getting so emotional. Do you feel that as a conductor?
Yeah, you can too sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think I feel more emotional when I'm listening to music away from actually performing it.
Okay.
Than I do when I'm performing, because of the nature of multitasking.
Yeah, in the zone.
So you always got to be alert, and you can't lose yourself too much.
Mm.
So, but yeah, there are moments in the scores you mentioned and in the Tchaikovsky trio of ballets, and even in Giselle. I mean, Giselle, it comes under a lot of criticism from musicians who think it's a substandard score. Well, look, it's not a standalone musical masterpiece, but it's a masterpiece of theatre. And it marries such a beautiful and tragic story.
It is, yeah.
Everything works so well together. And I think neither dance, not music would function. Well, obviously the dance didn't function without the music. But the music is not standalone at all. And similarly with the ballet, like Les Sylphides also, which is kind of weakish score, but when you pair it with the choreography, it works beautifully as a piece of early 19th century theatre. So there are moments. I mean, for example, going to Giselle in Act Two, which is the extended plein air with a beautiful solo for the viola. You know, again, a Cinderella-type instrument up till the 20th century. Adam, the composer, clearly had a player in his orchestra in Paris who was a beautiful, I mean, an exponent of the instrument. And that solo is something that the players absolutely would love to play all around the world. It lies beautifully for the instrument as well. So yeah, there are many moments in those pieces, as well as the ones I mentioned earlier. And not to forget, in the 20th century, the one-act classics by Stravinsky and Ravel. So I'm thinking Petrushka, I'm thinking The Rite of Spring, I'm thinking Firebird, I'm thinking Darkness and Glory.
Mm.
You know, those are standalone masterpieces, with or without a dance. And those are, we don't get great opportunities to conduct those pieces because they're expensive to mount, but fantastic to do. So yeah.
So, yeah, they are incredible scores. And I love what you're saying about that some are standalone scores that you can just listen to and enjoy just the intricate detail of it, but others it needs to be pieced with something else, and it just marries beautifully with the ballet.
Yeah,
I think that is great. What qualities would you say a conductor, specifically a ballet conductor, needs to possess?
Well, I think conducting for ballet is a collaborative role, so you need to be a good people person. Of course it's a leadership job, because at the end of the day you're directing. You know, you have to stand up there, be responsible, and sort of do the job as a leader. But you've got to collaborate with every department to make it really function. Stage management, choreographers, directors, individual dancers, and of course your colleagues in the orchestra. So the whole thing, I always use this analogy for conducting for ballet, which is, imagine a bicycle wheel, a push bike. It's a beautiful thing to see those spokes going round and round. And imagine you stick a stick in it. What's going to happen? It's going to stop. That someone's going to fall off. The stick's going to break. And that basically is what happens in ballet if the conductor steps outside of the box too much. So you have to be a partner as well as a leader. And that's where the job is slightly different to opera, because in opera, the conductor is kind of the boss and can overrule a lot of the decision-making if he or she is not happy with it. In ballet, of course, you have to have your say, you have to direct, and ultimately the two people who are running the show are the conductor and the stage manager, if you think about it.
Yeah.
We are responsible for running the show, but we can't stake our, you know, our wooden stick, if you like, into the spoke of the wheel, because it doesn't function. So you have to be generous, you have to be very flexible, and also, you know, tough when you need to be tough, but gentle toughness, because ultimately you still are a leader. So you have to be coercive, but not. Someone said to me, if you become a dance conductor, you have to put your ego in a box and lock it away. Well, that is basically true, although there are times where we have to stand up for the music. So, because it can't be a free-for-all either.
Mm-hmm.
You are responsible for the quality of the music and the flow of the music and getting the best out of the orchestra.
Have you got an example of that?
I think the best examples are when it's something new.
Right.
So, if a piece is already on history, there's very little you can do as a conductor to change it, because the choreographer or the director will turn around and say, well, it's always been done this way.
Yeah, yeah.
Or someone else has made it work that way. So therefore, you know, if they've made it work, you have to make it work. But if it's a new score and the composer has asked for something specific and the choreographer is not happy and they can't be to compromise, I've seen this happen and I've witnessed it. I'm thinking of a ballet called The King Dances, which David did. It's all set in the court of Louis the 14th. And it's about the concept, the actual birth of ballet, in a way, because Louis the 14th was the one who, so to say, invented it. But it's got contemporary music as well as back then, you know. And the composer, I won't mention names, great composer, but he was really not happy with one section. He felt the tempo was all wrong. It made his music sound inferior. And the choreographer was David at the time, said to me, but Paul, it has to be that way. Because that's how I've done it. And I know myself, it's going to look better. And I think the music can take it. And on this occasion, I agree with David. Not because it was the easiest solution, because you could argue, well, you know, I'll just keep everyone sweet. But the composer was not happy at all. He kept coming back to it.
Oh, gosh.
But in the end, I had to be frank and say to him, get it away, it's a him. We got on really well. He's an amazing composer as well, great guy. I just said, sometimes we don't have the option. And sometimes the person who has to make the final decision is me. And I'm deciding to do the quicker tempo. And I know you don't like it. I know this is better for the piece. So that's one example.
Yeah.
Where I had to make the final decision. I know David would have been nagging me if I hadn't done this. But I could have dug my heels in and said, let's reach a compromise in the middle. But I just felt that my experience and knowing, and it wasn't just because visually it looked better, although that was part of it. I knew that the music would work equally well at a quicker tempo. So ultimately I made the decision and that's what we did.
Yeah. I haven't seen it, but I'm sure it was the right decision. And David Binney is just, what a choreographer. Like, yeah. Astounding, the stuff that he produces and how he keeps that fresh. That's just a whole other thing. My goodness.
Well, another example, I've just been in Finland and did another piece with David, a world premiere of a ballet set to Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. And the music was by Sally Beamish, who's a very famous British composer, wonderful, and a great person. And she wrote this fabulous, theatrically strong score. Now, she provided the track, which had very fixed tempi on it.
Okay.
And a piano score. But David prefers to rehearse with pianists because it's more built. He knows where he can go from. And he gets the sort of live sound, which is, and I agree with him. You know, keep music live all the time, as much as we can. You know, if it's hip hop, I understand. It's track.
Yeah.
But now it turned out that the three pianists in the company in Finland had various ideas about tempi. And I don't know how closely they listened to Sally's track, but in some pieces, they didn't listen very closely. So they gave David what they thought was the tempo. And of course, in a lot of cases, well, in some places, he went along with what they gave him. In some places he asked them to do what he was used to in his head from the track. So when I arrived, I had to assimilate what they were giving me and what David had obviously taken on board from them, as well as what I had in my head, which was the track, and find out actually very quickly what would actually work. I mean, David is, as we talked about, a brilliant choreographer. He's very musical. He reads scores and he does give the conductor a good deal of flexibility. I'm not going to mention other choreographers that I work with who are on your case all the time, not only about individual sessions, but about subsections.
Right.
Yeah. And it can be very difficult. And sometimes you have to say, look, I understand, but you now need to trust me. I have to make this work. I have 65 players down there and I can change the tempo every 2 bars and I'm not going to do it anyway, but I will try and accommodate what you want. But you have to let the music have its own flow as well. So yeah, in Finland, there were certain places where I had to decide what would actually work and hope that they'd be happy with it. Those are examples.
Yeah.
New scores.
New scores.
Really, the conductor really has a place in the shaping of the piece. And of course, it develops during the run as well.
Yes.
You know, dancing will get better.
Mm-hmm.
And things that were seemingly too hard to go beyond a certain tempo initially. I saw this happen in Christmas Carol, particularly the court ballet, where initially they would say to me, oh, Paul, would you mind? This is really pushing us. And then by the end, they were whizzing through it because they got into their bodies.
Yeah. And it does take time from learning, developing a choreography to it feeling like you're dancing a piece of history somehow. Like it does sort of take a while. I remember that with Beauty and the Beast, I think it was.
Yes.
When initially you just like, this felt alien and really strange in the tempo. It felt funny. And then suddenly it was just pure enjoyment to dance. And probably the same for you. It would be just, I don't know. I'm assuming that maybe it was not flowing as well. Maybe it sounded like it was flowing, but maybe it didn't feel quite like it was in you, but then it was a part of you.
Yeah. I think that piece you mentioned took a long time to settle. It made several rewrites.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yes, we did.
Oh, wow.
Particularly the prologue. David wasn't happy with that conductor. I think 5 different versions before we finally settled.
Oh, gosh.
She worked and flowed better. And I think the whole piece just needed a better structure in terms of the tempi, particularly, and the overall flow of the piece. So I think we got there. It took a while. And sometimes that's the case. This is where we're lucky with repetition, as opposed to going in and out of the concert hall, you know, because the repetition can really play, particularly the new piece, can really help us a lot to really get to the, for the piece to settle and find its own way.
That's fascinating. I mean, God, what would you say is your absolute favorite piece to conduct, whether it was a one-act ballet or a full-length ballet?
That's a really hard question to answer because I think I don't have one.
Really?
No. I have many. So, but I don't have one standout. You know, I can name 10. I suppose of the one-act ballets, Stravinsky's Apollo is something that is very special to me, and it's a very challenging piece for the conductor, and it's rewritten for the strings. But there's a special sound that we have to try and achieve in that, which has got purity in it. And even in the faster sections, it should never sound too aggressive. You know, there's a sort of sustained beauty and almost a naivety at times in that sound. It's very hard to achieve. It's typically tricky in places as well for the players.
Can you describe what exactly you do to evoke that kind of outcome?
Well, there are several ways conductors get around those hurdles. There are some conductors that like to talk a lot in rehearsals. Orchestras generally don't like this.
Okay.
Especially in Britain. You know, you can't have to get on with it. And also they prefer conductors who show through their gestures more than actually through their words and talking. So yeah, you have to there's a lot of instinct. It's a bit like what makes a good dancer, you know, what makes a standout dancer as opposed to a good dancer. Because all dancers who work in classical ballet are good.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise they wouldn't get a job.
Yes.
But what makes the principals, what makes them special? And it's the same thing for a conductor. So there has to be a degree of, there's an X factor obviously involved, but it has to be instinctive, you have to be natural, you have to know how it works for you without talking too much. So gestures are very important. Eyes are very important. I never wear my glasses when I conduct, because I feel that I can communicate better with my lenses.
Okay.
Because my eyes are freer without a barrier.
Makes sense.
Trying to be as expressive as possible, you know, very much what we do. The danger, I suppose, with ballet is because as far as a lot of dancers are concerned, tempo is the thing. So it's very easy to become fixated on tempo and therefore to forget the fact that you're missing your phrasing. So phrasing is paramount all the time. So the music always has its shape. And as we evoke that special sound in Apollo, through gesture is, well, it's personal. It's individual. Conductors will do it differently. But as I say, a lot of it has to be instinctive and try to keep the talking to a minimum. But sometimes we have to say, look, explain the sound that we're trying to achieve. And orchestras, when they understand that, will then try and evoke that themselves in the rehearsal.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
My mind is like going 100 miles an hour. You're just like processing a hell of a lot of information. There's so much that I've learned today. There's so much that many people would be like, God, you know, it's so interesting to think about what really goes on for a conductor. It's not spoken about enough. Mm-hmm. I don't think people go to the ballet and they talk about what they're seeing on the stage, but they're not talking about, I mean, they are talking about the music, but they're not talking about how it works, mm-hmm. the mechanics of it. You know, I think it's such a special thing that you do. And without you, there would not be the ballet.
Well, I think also, you know, the orchestra, having an orchestra that's flexible and happy to adjust very quickly is so paramount to the success of a performance. And we're so lucky here with the Broadway Symphony because they are proud to be a specialist ballet orchestra. So and whoever's on the podium, they will respond very quickly to, as I mentioned earlier, to the subtleties, not only of the music, but also to shifts in tempo.
Yeah.
Because if you have an orchestra, well, I encountered this a lot, essentially, I remember the worst experience I've had was ironically one of the best orchestras I stood in front of in Valencia, with an orchestra, young orchestra that was assembled through the best players, a lot of your best young players. But it was many different opinions in an ensemble that didn't really work. And that was Apollo. And it, of course, sounded beautiful, but it didn't have the flexibility. It was too rigid. I couldn't persuade them to move and ebb and flow in the way that the piece demanded and that I would have liked. There were too many egos pulling in different directions. Too many suggestions. Let's try it like this. Because they were essentially used to playing for symphonic or opera, where, you know, they felt that they were more at home. But if you have an orchestra that's flexible and willing to explore, we're so lucky here. We have the Sinfonia. And I think that really is the contributory factor. Obviously, the conductor needs to be on top of their game and needs to be able to understand when to actually turn the screws and when to back off. I mean, a good analogy I had was a bit like driving a sports car. Not that I've driven that many sports cars. I know. But with a sports car as opposed to a normal car, when you open it up, it basically drives itself. And in a way, a good orchestra is like this. So from a pragmatic point of view, when does it actually need the conductor? Well, as you're driving your sports car, what happens when you put your foot on the brake, slows down? The orchestra needs the conductor to gauge the slowing down. When you put your foot on the gas, it speeds up. You need the conductor to speed up and turn corners, which we say. So the intricacies of little pauses or just moving on, coming back. So pragmatically, that's when the ocean, the sports car is its driver. But if you take that as a base level, that's the very bottom part of the ladder. How can you, on top of all that, then build it to something that it's going to be special for the players and for the audience, whilst accommodating the dancers. That's the challenge.
God, you have to be, so much the multitasker.
Yeah.
Very instinctive, intuitive, in tune with the dancers and the orchestra simultaneously. Like, oh, goodness me.
And if you have an answer who's not all very musical, it can be very difficult. Then you need to know when to ignore.
I hope that never happened with me.
And then there's dancers who fall into that category.
Right.
Certainly not so much now, but certainly in the past. And I think a lot of it was premeditated. A lot of those dancers decided that they didn't want to be on music. And in certain places, they wanted to play around the music.
You mean like holding a balance a little bit longer?
Or some players just going off-piste. One very famous, I'm not going to mention names, female, should we say, dancer, was actually very angry with me after a performance of Sleeping Beauty because I tried to accommodate her too much. She didn't want me to do that at all. She wanted me to basically just set the music and go with it. But then she wanted it the way she wanted it also. So it was very, very difficult. So the ones who are instinctively musical, it's a joy. Because then you know you're singing from the same energy immediately. They'll go with your phrasing. And I've been lucky. I've been so lucky. I, again, because about not naming names, but I can think of five dancers of either sex who've just been an absolute joy. And you just know each show is going to be, it's just going to be natural. And it's just going to go. We're going to be together.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that I don't have to be in the studio and rehearse with them so they're happy, which I'm more than happy to do, and what all conductors should do anyway, and the same as they would do in opera, they'd be in the studio and work with the singers. Not at the beginning of the choreographic process because they have to learn the steps.
Yes.
So as it's coming near the end, it's coming near the piano and stage rehearsals. So that week or 2 weeks before.
I remember you coming in and it would be like a week or two before the stage rehearsal, you know. Yeah. I always remember that, and you're there, you know, setting the tempo, and it would always be like very slightly different. So it'd be a little bit of an adjustment, but not too much. It's such a necessary part because you couldn't just go onto the podium and just go. It would not work.
No, but similarly, you know, I always use this again, coming back to the parallel with opera. There's no way you could go onto the podium with something like Love Win and just conduct it because you need to know all the tricks and the great. The direct comparison for Love Away is Sleeping Beauty. Because you look at something like Aurora's Act One solo, on the page, it looks really simple. Really simple.
Really?
It's just dead straightforward. And then you factor in that choreography and it becomes one of the most complex 2 minutes that you ever have to go through in your life.
Wow.
because it changes so much. There are so many little fluctuations and weights. Pirouettes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Two, three, do four sometimes.
Yeah, because sometimes not even the dancer knows. Depends how it goes in that moment.
Exactly. So that is something that's somewhat straight.
Yeah.
That's all.
Do you have any future projects coming up or anything that you're working on?
Well, I've just been doing this Christmas Carol, which was hugely exciting. And also recently I did another new ballet with David, because we've worked together a lot. And that was a version of A Comedy of Errors, the Shakespeare, which he said in a nightclub in Ibiza. Actually, it was a beach bar, not a nightclub, but there was a rave in it.
Oh, I'm there.
It was a score by Matthew Heinzen, Australian composer. He's a really good friend who writes very cross-genre music. There's a lot of rock and pop in there as well as classical.
Oh, lovely.
Technically very challenging for players, but great, great fun. They're very rhythmically driven. We're hoping to revive that. They'll be seeing Sarasota in Florida, so we're hoping to revive that. I have a long now relationship with the National Ballet in Japan, which I started in 2008.
Maybe.
Again, because of David.
Yes.
I'm doing a couple of revivals there this season. Then I'll go back again next season to them. I may be going to conduct the Tokyo Ballet again. I've already conducted for that once, but for the Rite of Spring. And I'm possibly going to return to them, although they're on tour. I think in Italy, do that. And then we have our Symphony Hall concert in Birmingham, which is a wonderful evening of music and dance. So we also get to be on display, playing symphonic music.
Lovely.
And the dancers do some duets, and you probably remember.
Yes.
And I have them behind me, so could do with some windmirrors or your guitar. Driving a car.
Yeah.
So I have to literally look around my shoulder sometimes. But it's a great thrill that evening as well. And of course, recently we've had our big hit of Black Sabbath. Now, I never thought I was going to be involved in that piece.
Really?
No. I just thought, this is not for me. So we actually brought in a specialist, Chris Austin, who's here, who actually composed the third act and arranged some of the first act with another composer. And then we had a separate composer for the second act. But Chris was a musical supervisor. It's very much his genre. He's very in our world.
Mm-hmm.
He's conducting in the commercial world as well as the classical world. And So composer, rather, and he's also a conductor. So he did it. And I think my initial idea was to have the guest conductor with him, a younger conductor, but that became not possible because that conductor wasn't available. So I thought, oh, come on, Murphy, you know, why not, you know. So I did it with him, side by side. And you know what? I loved it. And it's not what I was expecting at all. I started by getting to know the original tracks, which I immediately loved, because when I was growing up in Northern Ireland, I was very much into rock music.
Oh, brilliant.
And there were many really good Irish rock bands, like Thin Lizzy, for example.
Yep.
People were my sort of heroes then. I used to love Status Quo as well. So going back, this is in the 1970s. I love the tracks. And then, of course, Chris came up with something amazing for Act 3. I mean, really brilliant. But the challenge was we had to be on a kick track for most of it because Ozzy Osbourne's vocals were extracted for some of the ballet. So the only way that could function was we were all synced to that track in our earpieces.
Gosh.
And the orchestra loved it. Symphonically, it was great fun to play. And then we had a rock band as well. And an on-stage guitarist.
Yes, I went to see it. Oh, it was incredible. Yeah.
Really unexpected. I never thought I would be as invested in it as I was. And so that is, there are plans for that to be, of course, as you can imagine, right? So that's something also to look forward to. And it's going to have a new version as well as the big version is going to be slightly reduced for smaller venues. So, you know, many things.
Incredible. Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure. I think that I've learned so much. I'm going to be reflecting on it for quite some time. Just so lovely to hear, like I said, the other side of the curtain and how it's really working to be a conductor, and what an honor it is to conduct incredible ballets. But you are incredible. I remember being on stage and thinking that you're still doing it now, just as epic. And thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great to see you again as well.
It's been a long time.
So all those years ago.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're welcome. Thank you. I was indeed reflecting on this talk for a while. What an incredible experience. Paul's enthusiasm and love for classical music and dance had me listening to some of the ballet music I danced to during my career, and I bawled my eyes out. You really must check out Paul Murphy conducting with the Birmingham Royal Ballet and the company themselves, who are magnificent. They are still on tour, and I put the details into the show notes. I'm realizing more and more what a privilege it is to have created a platform for the arts, and I will continue to put all my efforts into making it the best show it can possibly be. Oh, which reminds me, if you haven't clicked subscribe yet, please, please do, as it really does help to boost the show. I really appreciate it. Big love to you all.